How are you, Mr. Hansmeyer?
Good. May it please the court. Counsel?
It does please the court that you're good.
Wonderful. My name is Dan Hansmeyer. I'm attorney with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, here on behalf of the appellants Anthony Fisher and Edward Dorsey. This is a Fair Sentencing Act case. Mr. Fisher was sentenced pre-enactment, Mr. Dorsey post-enactment. Not going to really talk about Mr. Fisher. This case, this court's decision in Bell is dispositive, but I would note that we presented three.
Your opening brief suggests in that footnote on page 2 that Bell may not be entitled to the tremendous deference we ordinarily accord recent precedent because the FSA issue was raised only in supplemental briefing and was evaluated as a question of plain error. Would you be kind enough to elaborate on the reasoning behind your suggestion and whether or not you have any support for this proposition?
Well, honestly, this brief, the opening brief went to this court the day Bell was decided. So that's what I didn't have any time to really address Bell.
2 days before you filed your brief.
Yeah, right. It was actually the morning that the brief had to be out to get in the mail. So, I mean, I think, you know, I was just noting that. Obviously, it's precedential. I mean, I'm not arguing that it's not precedential. I would, you know, I do know that there are three arguments that, as far as I'm concerned, 2A, C, and D this court hasn't addressed. So I would just present those for a reason to reconsider Bell. But with respect to the idea that the issue in Bell was raised pro se, but I mean, it was briefed by the attorney. You know, the quality of that brief. I think he had 10 days to write it. I have
but
no precedent
is
to say.
He may have been pressed for time, but things have been moving along.
Right.
We would really be swimming against the stream of all of the courts of appeals if we were to agree with your position. And even Judge Hornby's decision at the district court level, and I have the greatest respect for Judge Hornby, but nonetheless, other district courts have found that it really strains too hard to get over the fact that 1 U.S.C. Section 109 specifically refers to penalties. It's really not just a statute about extinguishment of prosecutions. It's penalties, forfeitures, liabilities.
Right. Well, that's – I mean, we don't – I would prefer to move on to Mr. Dorsey's post-enactment, who is sentenced post-enactment, if that's fine.
Sure.
If we can do that, because I think that issue is –
Judge Hornby's situation as
yes,
well,
right.
Post-enactment sentencing.
So I don't really want to talk about Mr. Fisher, if that's okay. On Dorsey, he was sentenced after the enactment of the act, and I think this issue is extremely important. It's one that's divided the lower courts. We've essentially offered
the district courts.
Yeah.
I don't think it's divided the courts.
That's what I meant, lower district courts. You're right. It
lower
hasn't been addressed by any.
Well,
hasn't been a,
not that low.
Haven't been addressed by any of the courts of appeals yet. We've presented two additional arguments. One is based on Judge Hornsby's decision in Douglas. By my count, there's at least over 30 district court judges who have found that persuasive.
But isn't it equally true that the FSA contains no clear statement of congressional intent on the question whether the act should apply to sentences handed down after its enactment? And if so, doesn't the savings statute kick in and compel the same outcome in Dorsey's case as we reached in Bell?
I don't think so. I mean, to the extent you want a clear statement, I don't think Supreme Court precedent requires that. The general savings statute is in derogation of the common law and has to be strictly construed. This idea that you need a clear statement to apply enactment in 2010 based on a law from 1871, I don't think is true. I think Judge Hornsby, what he did, he looked to Section 8 of the Fair Sentencing Act, which told the Sentencing Commission to amend the guidelines and to do it within 90 days, an emergency amendment. And I think the clear intent of Congress doing that is that the Fair Sentencing Act needs to apply now. Congress,
in the sense of what's the rush if you're still applying the old law to everyone whose conduct took place before the effective date of the first Fair Sentencing Act? That's what Judge Hornby was reasoning.
And that's exactly right, because if Congress doesn't want it to apply now, the guidelines are just amended in this November, not last November.
So explain to me a little bit. You had another theory mm-hmm. that I actually wanted you to elaborate on a bit, which is the fact that drug type and quantity
right.
have been held repeatedly by this court and
right.
others to be sentencing factors,
right.
not elements of the offense. Why is that important?
Well, it's extremely important because the general savings statute kicks in if this is a retroactive exercise, and our position is that it's not a retroactive exercise.
So
it's
it would
prospective.
Have to be an element, in your view, for it to be
Absolutely.
Within 109.
Absolutely. And that's because the statute infers to penalties incurred under the statute. If the Fair Sentencing Act is the law at the time Mr. Dorsey is sentenced, he hasn't incurred a penalty under the old statute. He's incurred a penalty under the Fair Sentencing Act. The argument essentially comes from the Supreme Court's decision in Landgraf, which I would consider a watershed case on retroactivity. The idea in before I move to Landgraf, let me just say what the government's response is, because I think it's just plain wrong. The government cites Marrero for this idea that you look at the conduct, the offense conduct. There's at least three problems with that. One, Marrero is a collateral attack, so there is no issue of retroactivity. Everyone agrees that that would be a retroactive exercise. Two, even more persuasive, is that Marrero involved a statute that contained a specific savings clause. And I quote that savings clause, it referenced any violation of law occurring prior to the effective date of the act. So when Marrero looks at offense conduct, it's doing that because that's what Congress told it to do in a specific savings clause. And then third, Landgraf, to put the government's argument to rest, this is a direct quote from the majority opinion in Landgraf. A statute does not operate retrospectively merely because it is applied in a case arising from conduct antedating the statute's enactment. So the government's reading of Marrero is just plain wrong. We have these rules on retroactivity that need to be addressed. And when you look at the majority opinion in Landgraf, it adopts a vested rights approach, which is essentially an ex post facto analysis. This clearly, the application of the Fair Sentencing Act is not ex post facto. It does not take away or impair vested rights, does not create a new obligation, it does not impose a new duty, it does not attach a new disability, it does the exact opposite.
Well, actually, the ex post facto clause would prohibit Congress from mandating a stricter penalty.
That's exactly right. So this is the converse.
In the FSA, but you're
right.
saying that it's, well, you're arguing essentially for a two-way street, that the stricter penalties can't apply, but more lenient penalties can?
No, I'm saying both. I'm saying on the retroactive issue.
Right.
If you look at Landgraf and its vested rights approach, something is retroactive under an ex post facto analysis. And this statute is the opposite of that. So it's not retroactive under a vested rights approach. I don't think that's even debatable. The second sort of interesting aspect of Landgraf is Justice Scalia's concurrence, where he talks about this temporal application approach. That's what I call it, where he talks about looking for a relevant retroactivity event. And that's important because in later decisions, this sort of snakes its way into the majority opinions. And we've cited, as an example, Republic of Austria v. Altman, which is a 2004 case. And that case is kind of interesting because there, the Supreme Court essentially decides that the relevant retroactivity event under this civil statute is not when the conduct occurred, it's when a claim was filed.
So right, I mean, but that's the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and
right.
really a whole different set of
It is, but it does show that the government's idea of looking at conduct isn't not a valid aspect. It's not a per se rule of retroactivity. So when we get to this instance and we talk about what is the relevant retroactivity event, when we do that, what our argument is, look, this is a sentencing factor when you talk about a mandatory minimum. That's black-letter law under Supreme Court precedent, under this court's precedent. That means that whatever sentencing factors are decided, they're decided on the date of sentencing. That includes relevant conduct that precedes the offense of conviction. That includes relevant conduct that comes after the offense of conviction. It could even include something that happens that day take acceptance of responsibility. That could be taken away on the day of sentencing if a defendant stands up and says something in allocution. A district court could take away acceptance of responsibility, which is a sentencing factor just like the mandatory minimum. So essentially, that is the retroactivity argument. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now we finally get to see what Mr. Koenig looks like. Well, he looks good to me.
Good morning.
Well, he's from Wisconsin.
Oh, that explains.
Please, the court. My name is Jonathan Koenig, and now that Judge Evans has commented adversely on my looks, I figure things can only go up from here.
All right, here it comes.
They're not going to go up
because this is my question. Before the FSA was enacted, this is what Attorney General Holder said. It is the view of this administration that the 100-to-1 crack powder sentencing ratio is simply wrong. It is plainly unjust to hand down wildly disparate prison sentences for materially similar crimes. It is unjust to have a sentencing disparity that disproportionately and illogically affects some racial groups. And he then said, before the FSA was enacted, there is no law enforcement or sentencing rationale for the current disparity between crack and cocaine powder offenses, and I have strongly supported eliminating it to ensure our sentencing laws are tough, predictable, and fair. So, Mr. Koenig, why is the Department of Justice, in Mr. Dorsey's case, in a seeming about-face, advocating for the continued imposition of sentences that, by its own admission, discriminate on the basis of race, lack any penological rationale, and are simply unjust?
Your Honor, we've had a long, long conversation in this country about the crack powder disparity and the racially disparate impact that ratio is said to have had. When Attorney General Holder made those comments and when Mr. Brewer testified before Congress, they were appearing in an advocacy role while legislation was pending. And
so everyone's changed their minds now?
Well, my point is just that what has emerged from the legislative process is clearly a compromise, certainly as to the ratio. It's very obviously a compromise. And I appear today on behalf of the department to defend the law that Congress passed. And I think the fact that it was compromised legislation counsels in favor of restraint on the part of the government and deference, frankly, on the part of the courts.
Well, you've come to the wrong court. Wouldn't continuing to apply what is really a discredited sentencing regime produce absurd results, because the statute of limitations for drug offenses is 5 years. Drug cases can take a very long time to try. And if your argument carries the day today, won't district courts be handing down really unjust, discriminatory, and unnecessary sentences for many years to come?
Well, Your Honor, those are, with respect, equitable arguments and policy arguments. Similar arguments were made by Mr. Marrero before the Supreme Court, and Justice Brennan concluded his opinion by saying, you know, undeniably these arguments have force, but they are addressed to the wrong governmental branch. Punishment for federal crimes is a matter for Congress, subject to judicial veto only when the legislative judgment oversteps constitutional bounds.
So, Mr. Koenig,
and then he concludes by saying, however unfair that may be to Mr. Marrero, who missed out on the opportunity for parole eligibility.
So my argument or my question for you has more to do with, let's say, a hard-headed legal question. The department worked very hard, as I recall, in the immediate post-Booker period, to have drug type and quantity classified as sentencing factors, and so those were things that could be found by the judge, by a preponderance of the evidence. They didn't need to be asserted in an indictment. The only thing you needed to put in the indictment was any fact that would change a statutory maximum. You didn't even have to worry about statutory minima because United States against Harris took care, you know, that just sort of happened. But when you found that minimum by this mere preponderance, the sentence followed. It seems to me this might be a be careful what you wish for situation, because I look at 1 U.S.C. section 109, and it seems to be referring to statutory penalties, forfeitures, or liabilities. It can't possibly refer to every single fact that the guidelines would let a district court judge take into account and find by a preponderance. Did somebody obstruct? Did somebody accept responsibility? Was it 28 grams, or was it, you know, 150 grams, or was it 7 grams? Those things all, the price of having them found by a preponderance may be that they really aren't the kind of penalty that 109 is talking about.
I think I understand Your Honor's question. Of course,
I mean, I'm trying to interpret 109 and also factor in the fact that not a single penalty level was changed. It's just the number of grams of crack that trigger these. Nothing went from a 10-year maximum to a 15-year maximum. Nothing went up or down on the minimum scale. It's just the number of it's the sentencing factor that changed.
Well, I think the penalties changed, though. The word that's used in the savings statute is penalty.
Well, the sentencing factor, which is different from, I mean, look, I didn't even like this distinction when it came out. I thought if it was an element of the offense, you should assert it in the indictment. But, you know, cooler heads prevailed, and the government's position that these were sentencing factors prevailed. So I'm just not sure when you look at the word penalty, it jumps off the page, whether it's talking about an element of the offense, the kind of thing that establishes a statutory maximum, or whether it's a sentencing factor, or whether it's something else. We need to understand what that word means.
Well, I would say that it orbits more closely to the statute than to, say, the guidelines.
Why?
Because it's part of the statute, for starters. And it is a penalty, again, to use the words of the savings statute, whether it's a sentencing factor or an element.
But it always has been in the statute, you know, where the sentencing factors were. But you don't have to charge it. You can just have this increase in penalty proven by a preponderance to a district court judge without using any rules of evidence.
I've tried to answer your question. I'm afraid maybe I haven't, because I don't know the answer, but in my mind at least,
well, that's
talking
the argument
about penalties
about this that worries me the most, yeah. I'll tell you. I think that a lot of the other things that the appellants are trying to raise have been answered by cases in other circuits or by Supreme Court cases. This is the one that really has me stuck.
So that's three of us. How about you, Terry?
I agree.
Well, I would like to make a few other points before concluding. I don't think, apart from perhaps the issue that Your Honor has noted, that Mr. Dorsey or Mr. Fisher have articulated, or Mr. Dorsey has articulated a reason to treat his category of cases differently from Mr. Fisher's or Mr. Bell's. And I guess we agree that Bell does control the outcome in Mr. Fisher's case. And that makes sense because the analysis under the savings statute is the same for both of them. It's has Congress either expressly or by necessary implication indicated an intent that, to apply the Fair Sentencing Act to sentences for conduct that predates the Act.
So why did Congress put in this emergency authority, which seems to be a complete unemergency under the...
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but I don't think that's necessarily or inherently a retrospective
kind of... But why isn't it a signal? You know, why isn't that the basis for the necessary implication? It's not just a clear statement rule. It's a clear statement or necessary implication.
Well, partly because the guidelines, of course, are advisory. And whatever Congress thought it was accomplishing by setting a 90-day timetable, it really wouldn't affect a guidelines disposition. Unless a particular sentencing judge were living under a rock someplace, that person would know, certainly, about statutory changes to the ratio.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure they all know.
So... see. I do also want to note another area of agreement, and I think that is that there is a category of cases where the retrospectivity or retroactivity of the act is unclear. That would be the Dorsey category. There are, for just for your information, approximately 24 cases in my district that would fall into this category. There will be more because of the statute of limitations, and there is great interest amongst the district judges in resolution of this issue. So if I could be somewhat presumptuous, I would urge the court to resolve it as promptly as possible and to affirm.
Hear that, other five cases? His is first. All right. Thank you very much. You use your time. I'm going to give you a minute. And after we give you a minute, we're going to take a five-minute break.
Let me make this
one. So if any of you need to take a five-minute break, you know, go ahead.
Let me make this one point because I think it's relevant and it brings home the retroactivity argument. Say my client's out on bail and he's dealing drugs while he's out on bail awaiting sentencing. And the morning he drives to the sentencing hearing, he stops and he does a controlled buy. The cops are on to him. At sentencing that day, you know, that can be considered relevant conduct. The government can come in and introduce that evidence as relevant conduct. And say he's at 4 grams, and that sale that day puts him above 5. He just earned a 10-year sentence on the date of sentencing.
Yeah, but that's not a real sympathetic argument.
Well, maybe it's not. But the point is that it's a sentencing factor. I mean, that's the point. So the relevant retroactivity event has to be the date of sentencing. If it's the date of offense conduct, it doesn't make any sense under the Supreme Court's rules on retroactivity. And I will leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, 5 minutes, folks.